Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The United States Senate, of course, is very much at the forefront at the moment on that battlefield. It is a place where, among other things, senators are mulling what to make of President Obama's deal, as he calls it, with the Iranians. A man who will be very much in the forefront, I'm quite confident, of the debate to come about that issue, the advisability of this agreement, and the implications of it, will be our guest, David Vitter, a United States Senator from Louisiana. Prior to his service in the United States Senate, he was a member of the House of Representatives. He is a man I've had the privilege of knowing and working with for a long time, not least on our defense against the kinds of threats that the Iranians are now mounting. Senator Vitter, it is a distinct pleasure to have you with us, especially at this moment. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for the invitation.
We have a couple of topics that I want to hit with you very quickly, but maybe if we could just start with your sort of sense of both in your own mind and that of your colleagues, what has the president wrought here, and what do you think the response of the Senate should be to it?
Well, I'm very concerned about this Iran deal. You know, I've thought for months, well over a year, that the president just desperately wanted virtually any deal with the Iranians. And, you know, when you go into any negotiation with that mindset, whether it's a big international negotiation or some smaller business setting, you're going to get a bad deal if that's clearly the mindset you have, particularly if you communicate that. And I think that's really been clear for some time. When I go more into the details of the deal, as I have been doing since it was announced, including in classified briefings, all of those fears are constantly confirmed and not rebutted. So I'm very down on it. I hope Congress has some meaningful say in the process at the front end instead of just completely irrelevant and at the back end, as President Obama would like.
You know, I'm reminded of the famous line from Senator Vandenberg back in the early days of the Cold War, where he was talking about being in on the takeoff if you want the Congress to be in on the landing. And that certainly seems applicable today. What do you make, Senator Vitter, of the idea that your colleague Bob Corker and his Democratic ranking member on the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Cardin, have come up with, which seems to give you something of a say, I guess, but it doesn't seem to track with the kind of say that the framers had in mind for you to have when they gave you a sort of a co-equal responsibility in the treaty-making process. Should we be concerned about that?
Frank, I agree with you. Bob Corker has been working very, very hard on that, and I compliment him, but you know, fundamentally, it was sort of faded from the beginning in the sense that years ago, we put a national security waiver on the Iran sanctions that really lets the president waive them should he decide almost no matter what. And that's what really weakened our hand. And so this Corker bill is apparently the best we can do, at least to get some Democratic votes. But it's a very modest involvement in the sense that at the end of the day, if just over a third of either the House or Senate side with the president, then he can basically do what he wants.
What really worries me about this, Senator, is that it's a terrible precedent for a president who has been playing pretty fast and loose with the Constitution on a whole host of issues, as I know you know. Which brings me to really the other topic that I wanted to hit with you, and that is immigration. The president has, of course, unveiled this executive amnesty. I know you are very deeply involved in the immigration issue, and I wanted to get your sense of both the practical repercussions of that decision, but also its implications from a constitutional point of view.
Well, I think this president has stepped over the line over and over again in terms of his legitimate constitutional authority. And this executive amnesty, which he issued last November, is one of the biggest examples of that. I think it's way over the line. You know, every president has significant powers, but generally they're the power to fill in the blanks of legislation, of statute, not to act contrary to statute. And I think the president in this case is clearly doing the latter, acting contrary to a lot of statutory law, not simply filling in the blanks. So I've been working to push back and try to block that action in any way I can. If there's any good news, it is that we've won a round in court. The federal district court in Texas stayed this action, said it was developed in an illegal way, and that was just heard before the U.S. Fifth Circuit. So we'll see. I have a feeling it's going to go all the way up to the Supreme Court. I certainly hope this stay continues in place so that he cannot execute this amnesty and make any court decision perhaps irrelevant.
You chair the Border Security and Enforcement First Immigration Caucus in the Senate, Senator David Vitter. Do you sense among your colleagues a renewed conviction that, especially in light of what the president is doing, that we've got to get on with the business of securing the border?
Yeah, absolutely, Frank. You know, this title of the caucus sort of says it all, Border Security and Enforcement First. And I think that represents the consensus view, not only of this Republican Congress, but of the country. We need to do this in a step-by-step approach. We need to do it in the right order. And enforcement has to be first. There may be other things that need to be involved, but enforcement has to be first. It's the border. It's also workplace enforcement, which is just as perhaps more important, because if we put in place a real workable system of workplace enforcement so that only people who are citizens or in the country legally can get work, that would largely solve the border issue.
Your colleague in that caucus, one of the leaders with you in the Senate on these issues, is Senator Jeff Sessions, of course. And I understand that on the 23rd of this month, a couple of days from now, he's going to be holding a hearing looking at another place where it seems the president is about the business of rewriting the law, namely extending through this mechanism called parole, essentially refugee status on Central American minors. With the possibility, Senator, as I understand it, that this may be applied as well to Syrians and who knows, Yemenis and God only knows what other folks that the president may seek to bring to this country. In light of what we're seeing, particularly with Somalis in Minnesota turning up in battlefields all around the world and the like.
Well, Frank, you're right. Jeff Sessions is a great leader on this, and I follow his lead over and over. I'm going to be at that hearing. It's another example of the president taking executive action that is contrary to a lot of statutory law, not filling in the blanks and the details, but working contrary to statutory law. And it is a big deal akin to an amnesty. So this hearing is going to be very important, and hopefully we'll be able to follow up with that by pushing back effectively against this overreach.
Do you anticipate, again, any Democratic support on these issues? It seems as though they've kind of chosen to turn a blind eye to what the president is doing, even when it is so fundamentally athwart the Constitution and the prerogatives and responsibilities of the Senate.
Frank, unfortunately, you seem to be right. You know, during the campaign, during the election year last year, a number of Democrats spoke out against the executive amnesty, suggesting this is really crossing the line. Well, that was during the campaign. After the election, when it comes to votes and actions, that has largely gone radio silent. We're trying to reach out. We're trying to build those coalitions and get those votes. But I got to tell you, and this was to some extent true among some Republicans, the rhetoric was a lot different before the election than after.
Funny how that works when you're actually before the American people, and this is something that they so clearly want. Senator David Vitter, we know you'll be standing for election shortly. We wish you the very best in your future activities, but also appreciate tremendously what you're doing in the United States Senate today. I hope you'll come back to us after several of these things begin playing out a bit further and see where we are and what we can do to help.
I absolutely will, Frank. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Next up, former CIA clandestine officer Claire Lopez joins us to talk about the Iran deal. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleisch for the Center for Security Policy. A key argument by the Obama administration to get a nuclear deal with Iran is that Iran must be kept a year away from getting a nuclear bomb. But according to a new Bloomberg article by Eli Lake, although the Obama administration has claimed for years that Iran was over a year away from making a nuclear bomb, it actually believed Iran was only about 3 months away. The U.S. Secretary of Energy told Bloomberg reporters on April 20th that the U.S. has assessed for several years Iran was only 2 to 3 months away from producing enough fissile material for one nuclear weapon. An intelligence source told Lake that the Director of National Intelligence declassified a 2 to 3 month breakout estimate on April 1st, 2015. This is another example of how the Obama administration has lied about its nuclear diplomacy with Iran to get a bad nuclear deal. Congress must dump this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we have with us one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, one of the people that I have had the privilege of working with now for some time and consider to be truly a national treasure.
She is Claire Lopez. She served for some 20 years as a clandestine officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. She's gone on to do a number of things since, notably featured prominently in a whole series of films and television programs and, of course, videos, including those we produce at the Center for Security Policy, where she is now a senior vice president for the Research and Analysis Program. Claire, it's always good to have you with us, and especially when there is so much going on in which you are truly expert. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Frank. I'm always glad to be back with you.
I'd like to start with Iran. Claire, you've been working on this tirelessly, both in terms of trying to understand the ambitions of this regime and specifically the dangers posed by its nuclear and terrorist and subversive activities. Maybe we could just set the stage a little bit by asking you to kind of characterize the Islamic Republic of Iran's regime itself. What is it about? What moves it? And why is it such a problem?
Well, you know, that's exactly the perfect place to start, Frank, because as we know, and as described very explicitly in the Iranian constitution, this regime constitutes itself as a jihadist regime, and it uses those terms. And it sets itself the objective of not only consolidating its jihad revolution at home, but also exporting it to the entire world, and it says so in its constitution. And it talks about the IRGC, its Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, as an ideological army. And so even including the Quran verse 860, which refers to striking terror into the hearts of the enemy, with all of that, you know, as a characterization of this regime in its own words, not ours, I think we have to be very cautious in the way that we deal with this regime, in particular as we approach things like its nuclear weapons program, its support for terror around the world, as well as its human rights abuses at home.
This, of course, causes some, when comments like yours are made, to say, well, you always have to negotiate with your enemies. You don't go about negotiating with your friends. So to the extent that you could, as President Obama argues he has, kind of isolate this nuclear weapons program of Iran's from its terrorism, its ballistic missile programs, its regional, you know, subversion and you know, ambitions for hegemony and so on, you could conceivably have an arrangement governing this one particular portfolio that would be in America's interest. From what you've said, that doesn't sound bloody likely.
Well, no, and the main reason I would say it's not at all likely is because we're still in the middle of the war. Typically, negotiations take place when one or the other side is either ready to capitulate, certainly to come to the table, or is too worn out from fighting to continue. That's not at all the case with Iran. We're still in the middle of the war. It's never been held accountable for all that it's done to kill, kidnap, torture, maim American citizens going back 36 years, including, of course, the attacks of 9/11, for which it's never been held accountable, to suggest that then we could somehow separate out one aspect of the Iranian offensive strategy, its nuclear weapons program, and separate that, expecting negotiations in good faith from everything else, and understanding that this is a regime that is governed by Islamic law, which, by the way, obligates Muslims to lie to non-Muslims when the objective to be achieved is obligatory, as this apparently is for them. It's simply foolish. It's foolhardy in the extreme and reckless to not just U.S. national security, but regional and even global stability.
I couldn't agree more. Claire Lopez, let me ask you, you have spent much of your professional life, of course, in the business of intelligence, collecting it often in very dangerous places behind enemy lines. You have, therefore, I think, probably as good an appreciation of what is involved when President Obama and his surrogates and apologists make representations about the verifiability of this agreement, going so far in some cases to say that this is really going to provide unprecedented
opportunities to conduct inspections inside Iran, and most especially to go anywhere at any time that the inspectors deem necessary to assess compliance with the agreement. How realistic is all of that? Is it truthful in the first instance? And if not, what are the implications?
Well, no, not realistic at all. As I know that you know, I think the first thing we have to look at is the fact that Iran's nuclear weapons program, begun in 1988 at the orders of the Ayatollah Khomeini, remained illicit and clandestine for 14 years at least, until 2002, when it was revealed to the public by an Iranian opposition group. So the program was born in deceit. Let's recall that Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, under which it is obligated to forego any technology that would lead to a nuclear weapon, much less a nuclear weapons program itself, and obligated to disclose all of its sites to the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, the monitoring agency of the United Nations for nuclear programs. And it didn't do any of that for 14 years until it got caught and revealed. And then, as I write in a couple of recent articles published by the Washington Times, the sites that were then outed, if you will, made public, places like the centrifuge enrichment facility at Natanz, or the conversion facility at Isfahan, or the heavy water reactor parallel plutonium route to a bomb at Arak, all those became opened up. Not because they fessed up, as they were supposed to, but because they got caught. And so to think that they would abandon such a tried and true method of illicitly pursuing what is to them, I think, this regime in Iran, the sine qua non, a deliverable nuclear weapons capability, to give that all up just because they got caught with a few places, I think is not realistic.
Not realistic, and probably not even something that they're going to accept in principle, let alone actually implement. Claire, you mentioned your series in the Washington Times. It reprised some very important work you had done with the Center for Security Policy some years ago now on the Iran lobby. Talk a little bit about the peculiar situation that occurred with respect to having the Iran lobby represented in the U.S. negotiating delegation.
Well, there are a couple of aspects to this. As I wrote, and thanks to the Center for publishing my original February 2009 article about the Iran lobby, which was something that I was writing about at the very beginning of the Obama administration there, had to do with this network of individuals, groups, NGOs, other think tanks, led in particular by one called NAIAC, National Iranian American Council, whose founder and president is an Iranian-born operative by the name of Trita Parsi, and talked about how that group was expanding its influence inside the Obama administration right from the beginning, 2009, of that administration. And as time has gone on, I think we've seen, and this is what I write in the article, seeing the results playing out really in front of our eyes, particularly with regard to these nuclear negotiations. If we think about where we began with the United Nations Security Council resolution, six of them demanding a halt to all nuclear enrichment in Iran, other resolutions and sanctions demanding that certain places like Fardo be closed down permanently.
Hold the thought, Claire Lopez. We're going to come right back with more with Claire on these Iranian negotiations and also the Islamic State straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A State Department spokeswoman yesterday declined to disavow a report claiming that President Obama is willing to provide $50 billion to Iran just for signing a nuclear arms agreement. Since the administration has adamantly refused to link that deal to Iran ending its threatening behavior in other areas, we must expect the mullahs to continue to engage in acts of terrorism. If Obama were to give $50 billion to a regime that engages in terrorist jihad, his administration would become a state sponsor of terrorism. Thanks to the president's signing bonus, Iran will be able to engage in still more murderous violence, destabilization, and conquests, even before Obama's deal enables it to get the bomb. Can there be any lingering doubt that President Obama is playing for the other team? This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Our guest is Claire Lopez, a senior vice president with the Center for Security Policy. She is a woman who has been tirelessly covering the national security beat, particularly as it relates to some of the dangers now emanating from the Middle East, notably from Iran. And Claire, you were talking a bit about how the negotiations have played out, and the sort of successive concessions that have been made by the Obama administration. Finish that thought and then tie in the role that this outfit, the National Iranian American Council, has been playing in these negotiations.
Yes, well, exactly. And so all of those previous negotiating red lines, even, if you will, about no enrichment, shutting down Fardo, shutting down Erek, have all been conceded now, at least in principle and as leaked, presented by the U.S. side of the framework talks. And I have to think that this has a lot to do with the influence of this Iran lobby, which has grown closer and closer to the Obama administration over these past several years. And we can see how the appointment of certain individuals, for instance, actually inside of the Obama administration. Let's take, for example, a young woman by the name of Sahar Nowruzadeh. And she formerly apparently was a NIAC employee, perhaps an intern even, but worked at NIAC previously. Well, now, 2015, we see her in open media on a list of senior White House aides attending a secure video conference in late March 2015 together with the U.S. negotiating team in Lausanne, Switzerland. And she is listed as the National Security Council Director for Iran, a former employee of NIAC.
Now, just to be clear, Claire Lopez, one of the things that we've learned about NIAC is, and your extraordinary white paper on the Iran lobby lays this out very powerfully, is that the Iranians consider it to be their lobby. So here we are talking about, literally, it appears, them placing inside the White House, inside the National Security Council, inside the negotiating delegation, people who have certainly at least an affinity at a minimum for the Iranian position and may even be more closely tied than that. This is extraordinary and scandalous.
Right. Well, I mean, the term itself, Iran lobby, is not something that I made up. I actually found it in the Iranian media in 2008, and it was transliterated from the English to something like Iran lobby dar Amerika, Iran lobby in America. And that's what was printed in the Iranian media. That's where it came from. And they were actually boasting about its influence on American foreign policy towards Iran. Well, with good reason.
Clara, as I recall, it was you who told me a story about a Facebook posting, I think it was, of Trita Parsi about how it was that he missed a meal in all of this negotiating. Talk about that.
Well, social media is a wonderful thing, and the postings on it can be a motherlode of information, as in this case, when towards the end of March and into the beginning of first day or two of April 2015, we see on Trita Parsi's open Facebook page photographs of him in the company, for instance, of one of his employees at NIAC, his research director, Reza Marashi, who, by the way, formerly worked for the Department of State in the Office of Iranian Affairs. And then a entry on his Facebook page from April the 2nd, where Trita Parsi writes, "Oops, just realized I haven't eaten lunch today. Been too busy gloating," quote unquote.
This is insanity, I'm afraid, that we're having representatives of the Iran lobby, designated as such by the Iranian regime itself, gloating over the outcome of these negotiations. It simply reinforces what you've been warning about now for some time, Claire Lopez, that this is neither an effective deal nor a deal perhaps at all, really, and certainly not one that is verifiable. Let me switch gears, because you've also been very closely tracking the Sunni strain of the global jihad. The Shiite strain under Iran is, of course, a very serious and ominous one, but so is the Islamic State, so is the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about some of the reading that you've been doing in the publications of the Islamic State as to what their agenda is vis-a-vis us particularly.
Well, there is a whole span of publications that the Islamic State puts out. It's prolific, really, in social media, on the internet, and different sites and different magazines. The one folks perhaps know more about is called Dabiq, D-A-B-I-Q, which is the name of a town in northern Syria where the Islamic State has written and believes that the end times battles, the battles of Armageddon, will take place. Of course, that happens only if and when the Romans, as they like to call the Westerners, come with ground troops and engage the Islamic State forces on the ground in this region. The other publication, though, that I was reading most recently is part of what they call its Black Flag series. And it's got black flags from the East, black flags from Syria, black flags from Persia. The one that I wanted to mention is called Black Flags from Rome, parentheses, Europe. They use Rome as a term meaning essentially Christianity or forces of Christianity or Europe, sort of interchangeably. And talking about Europe, in this particular issue, there's a whole page that's labeled, entitled, How to Take, Hold, and Expand Territory. And they mean in Europe, in the West. And the first note, the first point under that heading is, make base of command and one leader. Quote, in this case, it will probably be the main mosque. And train men together in shooting, etc., to form a militia. And it goes on with other points. Get weapons. Build up a cash supply. Consolidate territory. And so forth. This is how the Islamic State is talking about using mosques and Islamic centers as basis of command and control for jihad.
Yeah. And Claire, you know from your work on these Islamists and their traditions rooted in Sharia that this is not an anomalous sort of approach to these facilities, is it? That in fact mosques have historically been used by Muslims for everything ranging from sort of pedagogic centers and training and you know community centers to arsenals. Is that not right?
Well, exactly. And what I was going to say is that this advice in this particular issue, which can be found online, by the way, Black Flags from Rome of the Islamic State, coincides precisely with how Muhammad behaved and acted and the steps that he took in the early days, as we are told in the recounting of it, at least, in building the Islamic community, in particular after he made the hijra from Mecca to Medina. He, Muhammad, is reported to have established a mosque and then used the mosque as the center of the community, yes, for prayer and worship, teaching, as you say, and indoctrination and so forth, but also as a command and control center for jihad to expand the community, to grow the community outwards, to take territory. And this is echoed in writing by Muslim Brotherhood figures, from Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, to Sayyid Qutb, who was one of the key ideologues of the Muslim Brotherhood, all the way to such writings as The Methodology of Dawah from 1981, written by and for the Muslim Brotherhood community in America by Shamim Siddiqui, which outlines as well the kind of establishment of facilities like mosques to establish a footprint and grow the footprint outwards from there.
Mm-hmm. Claire, we're going to have to pause again for a moment. When we come back, I'd like to see if you could sort of stitch all of this together, the lobbying, the influence operations, the penetration of these, Muslim communities through the mosques and in other ways. For the purposes of describing what is happening in Europe in all of these regards and what it appears it portends for us if we're not careful. All that and more with Claire Lopez, Senior Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, former clandestine officer of Central Intelligence Agency, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGT. SullivanCenter.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
My guest is my colleague and friend Claire Lopez, our senior vice president at the Center for Security Policy, where she is responsible for our research and analysis. She has served in a number of capacities, notably as a clandestine officer in the United States Central Intelligence Agency, and has been involved in the years since she left the business, came in from the cold, I guess they say, in training others to do that very important work and helping the rest of us understand the stakes of the kind of strategic environment that is setting up. And Claire, we've been talking about several different aspects of this. Let me turn to the sort of place in which, in some ways, if you know what to look for, all of these strains of this global jihad that you've been warning about are kind of much in evidence, namely in Europe. I understand you saw, and I had a chance to look at part of, a new film by the Christian Action Network. Marty Moyer is its director. entitled Europe's Last Stand, America's Final Warning. Give us a sense of what this film was about and some of the most important takeaways for the viewers.
Yes, this is a remarkable film, and I'm really glad that we can recommend it to the listeners. Martin Moyer, as you said, the director of the Christian Action Network, took 4 years with camera crews to film and record the footage for this film, which in its full length is 2.5 hours. I got to see a 38-minute composite of the entire film a short time ago. But over these 4 years of filming and editing and producing this film, what the group did is documented just how far along Europe is in essentially imploding. It is documented in the film how Muslim immigrants, not just necessarily there for the purpose of economic advancement or to find a better place in life and so forth, although many may be, but that a significant percentage of those coming to Europe over the last several decades have come with the intent to do just what I was talking about, taking from the quote from that Islamic State document, the Black Flags, and that is to set up communities that would be bases of operation for expansion and conquest, quite frankly. And all across Europe now, because it's been permitted over all these years that many of the incoming Muslim immigrants were not expected to assimilate, were not expected to accept and take up European traditions and accept the laws, live within those laws, but rather formed communities, enclaves. Yes, no-go zones. That might not be the most perfect definition of these places, but what we're talking about and what is in the film are communities where Islamic law, not the host country law, dominates, where security, emergency, police forces hesitate to go without armed protection because they might be attacked if they did, where non-Muslims are distinctly unwelcome and are made to feel so if they ever wander into these places, and where some of the most un-Western aspects of Islamic law prevail, like underage and forced marriages, honor killings, female genital mutilation, and the domestic abuse that is so explicitly sanctioned by the Quran.
Yeah.
So
these are all in evidence in Europe and apparently growing. The one you mentioned that we might spend just a moment more on is this practice of the Hijra, as it's called, because this, of course, is the subject of a new book by one of our colleagues, Anne Corcoran, about our own refugee resettlement program. But just set that piece up by talking a little bit about some of the stunning demographic changes that are taking place in Europe, Claire, and how that's translating into changes in terms of policy and in terms really even of the societies themselves.
Exactly. And this is the Christian Action Network's point, really, in making this film, to show that European society is undergoing widespread and perhaps irreversible changes by allowing these communities. And you mentioned the Hijra, Frank. The Hijra, of course, referring back to Muhammad's first immigration from his hometown of Mecca up to Medina, where he then established, became stronger, grew, and began to launch jihad against Jews, Christians, and other non-Muslims in the peninsula that would become called the Arabian Peninsula. And that is the echo of what is happening in Europe, that communities are making the Hijra, immigrating not for the purpose of integrating, assimilating into Western culture and communities in Europe, but rather of establishing outposts from which they then spread their influence and their law. This is about Sharia.
It's a kind of colonization for the purpose of changing these polities and, as you say, imposing this Sharia code. And Claire, turning to the United States, because, of course, we are all very concerned about the possibilities that these same forces, the jihadists, the global jihad movement, adherence to Sharia, the Islamic supremacists, whatever you wish to call them, have ultimately their sights set on us. The Iranians, going back to that outfit, couldn't be more clear about their desire to bring, as they call it, death to America. But give us a sense, Claire, based on your study of the Muslim Brotherhood and its civilization jihad, this refugee resettlement program that the United States government, as Ann Corcoran has documented, is using to help foster this hijra in our own country. And in other ways, the degree to which we now find here, even in this land, some of the same trends at work that are so ominous in Europe.
Exactly. I mean, we may be considered to be perhaps 5, 7, I don't know, maybe 10 years behind what is happening in Europe. The same thing going on here, as Ann Corcoran documents so well in her new monograph from the center, published by the center, called Federal Immigration Policy, Refugee Resettlement, and the Hijra to America. And the pattern is the same. The establishment of enclaves, insular enclaves, where host law may not prevail, where Sharia is implemented. And in the United States, we see, as Ann documents, not just mosques being set down in the middle of, for instance, the Bible Belt, the Christian Bible Belt of America's central states, let's say, where there aren't big Muslim populations now. But again, Hijra. The mosque is built, the population of Muslims comes and settles, buys out and expands the land and the footprint around the mosque. But then also, as the population of that enclave grows, demands are made, first of the local law enforcement to recognize the law of Islam within the enclave, then outside of it, in other words, that these Muslims would be exempted. They would be allowed to operate and exist and function outside of host country, in our case, constitutional law. And they make these demands. And as the percentage of a Muslim population in the West, in Europe, it's been documented to a much greater extent, of course, than here so far. But it seems that as that population percentage within the broader population approaches 3 or 4%, it's a kind of a tipping point when the demands escalate, the activity becomes more aggressive, and we see local law enforcement and politicians beginning to acquiesce to the demands. And that's what's changing the European landscape.
Claire Lopez, this is indeed of such moment and so worrying in so many respects. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate the work that you do, the clarity that you bring to characterizing the problem, and the real font of ideas about how to contend with these forces of Sharia that under your leadership the center has been doing, I think, really important work on. Keep it up, and we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. And to the rest of you again, I hope tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.